For those whom I haven't met directly, and otherwise, I'm John Backey. I'm the coordinator of the Lutheran Peace Fellowship and the pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in New York City. I mention those two together because in describing the work of the Peace Fellowship as we've understood it, we've understood it as a ministry and understood it in terms of parish ministry, especially as a resource and very much tied to the needs of parishes and the kind of work that goes on there. So they're not separate identities for me, but two facets of my vocation at this time. What I'd like to do is spend a little time following Dan's model last night, that there are two ways to do theology. There are two ways to talk about something like the Lutheran Peace Fellowship. And I could spend time, obviously, describing how many members there are and how you get on the mailing list and those sort of things. And I'll do a little bit of that. But I'd rather talk about it in terms of the way we have approached situations or the way we understand our work in terms of our experience and our daily practice. And much of what I say will be sort of anecdotal and scattershot in some ways, and feel free to stop me any place and ask things. Let me do the factual stuff first, very briefly. The Lutheran Peace Fellowship was founded during World War II as a ministry to Lutheran conscience objectors in World War II. There were more than 110 Lutheran men who decided that their faith... World War II. There were 110 Lutherans who felt that their faith would not allow them to participate in war, even World War II. And without dwelling on that history, if you want to know some more about that period, you can talk to Howard Hung, those of you here from St. Olaf, who was involved at the time. We're an independent inter-Lutheran fellowship agency, if you will, that has struggled since the mid-1940s to preserve a witness within the church and to the Lutheran community on questions of war and peace, individual conscience, nonviolence, and as it comes up again and again, the draft. Over the course of the years, the stance of the so-called official Lutheran churches has changed. In the mid-1940s, Lutherans were not allowed to be or were not recognized as conscience objectors even by their church. It was not seen as a legitimate position. By the 1960s, there was some acceptance of that idea. We continue now supporting the church in the ways that it helps or tries to minister to conscience objectors, but also try to go beyond that to work with young people who feel called to not register or to resist the draft in a variety of ways. We maintain an office relationship with other peace organizations, publish a newsletter, and help just basically keep people in touch across the country. Right now, more than 1,300 on the mailing list. And we have certain projects. We can get in, they'll probably come up in the course of the talk. You've heard about some of them, the taxes and such. If you have, excuse me, questions, you can ask them. But after, also, there's two pieces of literature here, one called 10 Questions about the Lutheran Peace Fellowship, which may answer some of yours. And the other one is called An Open Letter on the Nuclear Arms Race that we wrote and distributed 3 years ago now as a way of trying to call the church's attention to the problems of the arms race as we saw it. And that is a sort of a quick summary in much the same way that Dan spoke last night. A lot of the same sort of points are in there. Let me just say a little bit about myself. Dan asked me how long I've been doing this. In some form or other, I've been involved in anti-war related kind of things roughly for about, I'm trying to remember, but it's about 18 years. And that may seem like a long time, and it makes me feel tired until I meet guys who've been doing it for 40 years or more, and then get things in perspective, at least. I was a draft resister in the Vietnam era, was never prosecuted. Have worked for the Quakers, and work now, besides the Lutheran Peace Fellowship, with connections with other religious peace organizations, Sojourners Fellowship, the Fellowship of Reconciliation. There are about a dozen other denominational fellowships like ours, Catholics, Buddhists, Methodists, Presbyterians. We work in concert with them at times in a variety of ways. Sometimes I go to colleges and speak, as consultant to national church kind of things, a lot of different kind of stuff, as well as working within my local congregation as these questions touch our lives there, trying to counter military recruiters, working to counteract the effects of budget cuts where the money's going to the military and out of our neighborhood, etc. One of the things, that's so much for the factual stuff. One of the things that we've tried to do as we've approached situations as they come up, whether it's the draft or nuclear weapons or whatever specific place you want to come down in the broad spectrum of this work, is try to introduce or raise questions that we hope brings a different perspective, a different way of seeing, a different way of looking at things to the questions involved. That there's probably, let's take the draft for example, when most people in the church hear the government wants to start kidnapping their children again, they say, well, that makes sense to me. I guess we've always done it that way. And we try to raise the question, is that a legitimate way for the government to relate to its citizens? And if we think not, what do we do about it? And try to raise questions to allow people to get a little bit different look at it. And sometimes it's shocking and sometimes it's difficult and not always apparent. And just as sometimes just dismissed as being, you can name it, foolish, dangerous, crazy, whatever. In the movie Gandhi, if you get a chance to see it, please do. There are a number of wonderful incidents. But in one of them, after Gandhi has begun his campaign for Indian independence, after he's done a few things, there's finally a meeting between the military rulers and the governors on the one side of the table and Gandhi and his associates on the other side. And they're bantering back and forth, and the British being very paternalistic and sort of rationalizing why they're there. And Gandhi just keeps talking about independence and the need for independence. And one of the British officers finally stands up and says, well, Mr. Gandhi, you talk a lot about independence, but you haven't told us how you expect that to happen. You certainly don't expect us to just walk out of the country. And Gandhi just very calmly says, oh, yes, that's it exactly. That's what I expect you to do. You will reach a point where you will just walk out of the country. Gandhi could see that. He had the perspective to see, to have the vision, whatever, to see what was necessary. And it was so far out of the line of sight of that officer, he couldn't imagine. He couldn't see it at that moment. Gandhi having told him that, it happens much later down the line. But it's a difference in perspective, a different way of looking and saying to people, yes, indeed, the problem is not nearly as hard as we make it to be. It may be as frightening as we think it is, or we may build it up even more. We need to look at it a different way. One way we try to do that, which is not always so popular, is to try to, when we're approaching questions, say, with a nuclear arms race specifically, there's a great tendency to make those questions and the problems involved questions of great importance and difficulty. Where you will often hear, well, we're not experts in this, we're not scientists, you have to trust the government, there's a whole line of things that are said. It's much too difficult for church people to understand. Whatever, you're just being emotional, you're being simplistic. And so we try to do two things. One is to find basically analogies, other ways of describing what's going on and asking people, if this were the case in another setting, how would we react? Let's not talk about multi-megaton weapons and the military establishment. If you look at the behavior there and what's going on, you could describe it as an addiction. If we had alcoholics in our congregation, they would have the same kind of rationale that the military has for its weapons, for the need for their weapons, for everything else they do, but we probably wouldn't stand for it. We would say, you need help. You need to go to a hospital, and the first thing we do is take away your chemicals. To find other ways that make sense to people to demystify, in a sense, all the things that go on when you start talking about the military and its weapons. Someone asked me last night in a discussion, you always come up against the question of saying, well, that's all well and good, but what about Hitler, an extreme case, or the ultimate case? And again, to be able to say, that's exactly the point here. What about a system that's so inhuman that it enforces its will the way that Hitler did, and be able to say Hitler is not just, or that experience in Germany is not just bad history, but it's the current times, and that if we were German citizens, we would have hoped that we would have tried to shut down Auschwitz. And where is Auschwitz today? It's the Trident submarine just a few miles away from here. Telling people that will not automatically get a response of, oh, I never saw it that way, and God, thank you for telling me, now I'm clear. But you never know the long-range results either, of trying to get people to see things differently, to help people to stop avoiding the reality of the situation as it faces them. The second part of that is to deal with the charges of being simplistic or emotional. And the first few times I heard that, you get very defensive and say, oh, the worst, I don't want to be emotional about this, I'm sorry. And then you learn to say, it's not bad to be emotional about this. I tend to get emotional when someone threatens my children's life or my own. And if these experts are so smart, how do we get in this mess anyway? I don't need an expert to tell me how I ought to live. I have a different type of expertise. And the expertise on living does not come from scientific or so-called strategic expertise. It comes from living itself and experimenting in living and finding out what that means and what directions we take, and to not avoid being what's called simplistic, to put the burden of proof, as it were, on the other side, and say, what's wrong with saying we will have a foreign and domestic policy based on the simple proposition that the utmost importance to us is saving children's lives, that's the standard of measure for our foreign policy? Well, the charge is that's simplistic because whatever reasons, it's much more complicated than that, international finance, governments, all that stuff. That's a reality, but it doesn't answer the question. It doesn't answer the question as to where we're called and what sort of priorities we need to have. One of the main areas that we've begun to work in, or have been working in for a while, partly out of my own preference and inclination, and partly because of the need, is work for support within the Lutheran community, education and support around what is commonly called resistance. Simply put, people expressing their faith in such a way that they come into direct conflict with the laws and structures of society and often wind up in jail or elsewhere, out of work, etc. It's a very difficult concept for us to just sort of take in. You heard some of it last night when we talked about taxes. It's the kind of thing, I don't think I could do that. It's so frightening. It's so whatever else. I just don't want to think, couldn't we do it some other way? Couldn't we have a freeze vote? Couldn't we do all these things? Those are probably necessary and good things to do, but there's a whole spectrum of things that need to be done. We've learned that from experience, and that one, probably without the other, is not sufficient. This past November, when the freeze initiatives were on the ballots in many states, which were probably useful educational and public gauges of public support and interest, there were actions at the Pentagon around Election Day. People were blocking entrances and trying to get into the offices and putting their expressing themselves through putting their lives and their bodies on the line under the theme, if voting could end the arms race, voting would be illegal. We need to take that perspective more seriously in terms of as at least one facet of the range of ways of looking at this. And in trying to understand what kind of reactions come up for us and what kind of obstacles we face and why it's important to look at, I'm read an interview with a woman who had been a member of the resistance, basically the underground in the Netherlands, helping Jewish people escape from the Nazi occupation. And she said one of the difficulties they had after the occupation was that the people had an incredible concern, the citizens, about being polite. That they had been taught that it was wrong not to be polite. And so when German soldiers would come to them and say, "Where are they hiding Jewish people?" the people didn't want to appear impolite and not answer their questions, so they would tell them. Because they didn't, you get the sense of that, they didn't want to. And they had to do a whole educational campaign and keep reminding people, sometimes it's all right to say no. You don't have to answer all the questions. You know, you may be worried about what your mother thinks if you're impolite, but there are more important values at stake here in terms of whether or not we're polite. And you will come up against that over and over again. There are things that we will do, and in some way or other we will be told, well, couldn't you do that some other way? Couldn't you be, in essence, more polite? Do you really have to lie down in front of that door? Do you really have to pour blood on that door, on that machinery, whatever? It's not very polite of you. It's not spoken that way, but that's really the essence of what's going on. And to be able to say, mass destruction of this world is not very polite either, and we'd like to get some basic rules of etiquette down here about how we're operating. One of the difficulties as well that ties into that, two of the things that I'm always sort of driven by in the life of St. Francis by Nikos Kazantzakis, there are two characterizations that he describes as involved in Francis' life and in his ministry. One is that Francis was always driven, especially at the beginning, by this voice that whenever he did something, he built the church or he helped someone, the voice would come to him and say, "Not enough, not enough." It's a very harsh judgment, and it can become an obsession in some ways if we're not careful. But there's always that sort of tension in our lives. Whatever we've done, we have to look out and say, "It's not enough." Things, they keep making those weapons. We haven't done enough. We haven't done enough of the right thing. We haven't done, and we have to keep questioning and looking at what we're doing. Without thinking that we know absolutely what the right thing to do is. We keep trying and experimenting and learning along the way. And the second one, especially early on in Francis' ministry in this book, is the realization when he was called to go back to his hometown and ultimately face up to the people who knew him after he'd had some of this conversion experience. He didn't want to do it. That was the last place he wanted to go, right? Back to the people that knew him. And what he was told, he says, "Francis, you're ashamed before men because you're not ashamed before God. The way you live, the way you've been living, you should be ashamed before God, but you're not. You're just oblivious to that. And you worry more about the judgments of the people around you and your friends and all that. And once you get into the right relationship and recognize how far you've been from what God would have you be, then the judgments of the people around you will not matter as much or not at all." As we look at those sort of difficulties, the ways in which our lives are touched by the arms race and the things we're called to, we can come up with a whole list of, it's my list right now, of things, of reasons not to do more, or reasons why I should be doing something else, or whatever. It's a fearful experience to come up against public opinion and the government and feel so all alone, and how do I know I'm right, and maybe things will get worse if I do this, and there's a whole list of fears and excuses. For myself, for a long time, I kept telling myself, well, I'd like to do something dramatic and meaningful and take a risk, but, you know, my congregation couldn't get along without me if I had to go to jail for a sustained period of time. And I'm too important to the congregation, and I have kids. How would my kids get along without me? And all of those sort of things. And then I met a woman named Molly Rush, Molly was a member of a group called the Plowshares 8. Do any of you know the Plowshares 8? By any chance? You've heard? The eight of them, a couple of years ago now, went into General Electric factory in Pennsylvania and accomplished what we consider the first act of real disarmament since World War II. Started literally beating swords into plowshares by disabling some components of Mark 12 missiles with hammers. But Molly's a mother of six. And where I had been saying, because I have children, I can't do something like this, she finally said, because I have children, I have to do something like this. And that's something I'd rather not think about. I'd rather talk to someone else at times. To come up against the fears and excuses and the way we use and make into idols our families, our relationships, ways to protect us from the call to our own vocation, to the gospel that we may be called to. Because ultimately, what we're dealing with is the things that we fear the most. What's likely to happen to us for each of us would be different, whether we fear jail or disrepute or being impolite. Those are all forms of death. And we haven't yet come to grips with how much we fear death and how much that really controls our lives and keeps us from living as fully as we ought. Jail and discredit and all those things are different forms of death in our lives, but just as different ways that death breaks into our lives. And to try to stand up to those idols, up to those powers, and say, however timidly, in the words of the gospel hymn, you can't kill me because I've already died. And try to just stand up and take what we fear the most and find out it wasn't so bad after all. That the fear was in many ways much worse than the actuality. And you start to discover, as one friend said, when you take actions like this, one thing that happens is that friends walk away, but strangers come close. People you never knew before suddenly appear to support you, help you, whatever. And you start to move into a whole different community. All of that are elements of the way we have tried to approach the idea of peacemaking as ministry. Beyond the immediate question, or including the immediate question, of nuclear disarmament and the nuclear arms race, how do we understand in our ministry, in whatever form that takes, in our own vocations, the call to peacemaking, the call to be peacemakers wherever we are? And we find ourselves in a time when, if we have the eyes to see, if we allow ourselves to be shown, that these questions, the reality of the all-encompassing nature of the demonic powers reach into every level of our lives, that you can't deal with your children without worrying about the fear of whether they have a future. As you're trying to decide what kind of jobs or vocations or careers you'll have, all kinds of questions come up there. In the church, you can't talk about stewardship without wondering where people's money is going in their taxes, where our energies and resources are going. You can't talk about evangelism. What's good news in the midst of all of this? Can't talk about worship. Who are we really worshiping? Worship has nothing to do with the color of the hymnal. It has to do with where you put your allegiance, where you put your faith. Then in that sense, the peacemaking should be as pervasive in our lives as the powers of death already are. And that's something that we can't do alone. Hence, we try to put the emphasis on the fellowship nature of Lutheran Peace Fellowship as we struggle together, and as a person in one place is going to jail, we let other people know about that. As a person loses a position one place, we try to help and encourage them, if nothing else, and let them know they're not alone. And try to make some connections in people's lives and say, it can be so overwhelming. How do you decide whether we're going to deal with hunger or the arms race or the problems of patriarchy or the fact that people need jobs? And to try to counteract that separation and fragmentation by saying what we're called to in the gospel is a wholeness, is a healing of those kind of divisions. So we don't have to talk about one at a time, this and then this and then this, and to say what we've learned is that just as we've described before, sin as somehow alienation, as separation from God and one another, and in that sense, nuclear weapons represent the ultimate in that. They separate us down to basic elements. That the way that we deal with that is to counteract that separation and alienation by forming community, by reaching out and breaking down the barriers and touching one another, finding one another, and struggling together without necessarily knowing where we're going. Seeing these are not separate problems, but they're all connected in ways that may not be totally clear to us. We've taken it in a sense, and it may be presumptuous, say that as an organization, as a fellowship, our vocation seems to be asking questions. Questions sometimes, most often, we don't have the answers for. And that can be, as John was saying the other night in the talk about theology of the cross, it gets real depressing. Even when you say, well, isn't it good that the ALC has a statement now on the freeze and you want to feel good about that, in some way you also wind up being the spoil sport or the wet blanket saying, yeah, but what about something else? What about going farther? What about conventional arms to Latin America? What about, and you start to appear to be that sort of negative person nobody wants to have around, right? Person nobody invites to parties and things. So that we also have to try to articulate, besides the questions and the negative, what sort of vision we'd like to have, and try to help people imagine a number of things. I want to finish this part with two stories, really, that deal with that last part without getting into too much detail on it. Or three, actually. One, we've had to grapple in my own parish. We were talking the other day about fine tapestries or stained glass windows. We're in the process of renovating an organ. It's an old organ. It's 75 years old. It's going to cost us $25,000. And I never envisioned that I'd be in a position of raising $25,000 for an organ. We've just about done it, but it's made sense to me. One, and maybe I'm rationalizing. It hasn't cut into the feeding ministry and other things that we do. But also, it's one way of saying, of holding up what things we would like to have, that we could put $25,000 perhaps into working against the arms race, but we'd be a community without music and a community without beauty in that sense. And to try to find ways of expressing not just the saying no to the weapons, but what it's important to us as well is the beauty, is the poetry, is the weaving, is all these sort of other expressions that are signs of wholeness, of the kind of things that we'd like to have, as well as always questioning ourselves about whether we're getting carried away with that and not feeling badly. That story was told that after Castro succeeded in Havana and Cuba in the 50s, one of the first impulses was to tear down all the fancy hotels that had been built by the foreigners who were coming there to gamble and carry on. And they didn't do that because they said, well, wait a minute. The people of this country deserve nice things. Why don't the hotels are here, we don't have to build new ones, but these are nice. Let people enjoy them. Before they were excluded, let them enjoy the mosaics and all the things. They're not bad in and of themselves. They're bad if we get carried away with them, and there's always that temptation. People in my neighborhood, just as much as they need food, need music and need those kind of positive expressions. The last two sort of anecdotes that or sermon illustrations for anybody that wants these, to sort of sum up the way we've tried to approach our work, and I've been doing this specifically in the Lutheran Peace Fellowship for 8 years, and both of these come from Daniel Berrigan. One is just a brief story about a bird lying in the road and with its legs up in the air. And a rabbi comes down the road and says, little sparrow, why are you lying on your back in the road with your legs in the air? And the bird says, Rabbi, it's terrible. The sky is falling. And the rabbi said, that indeed would be terrible, but it doesn't explain to me why you're lying in the road with your legs in the air. And the bird said, I'm doing what I can. The second one, someone asked, in somewhere in the latter part of the 1970s, asked Dan why his brother Phil seemed to be in jail so much. All during the 70s, Phil was in and out of jail for various acts of witness or in and around the Pentagon and elsewhere. And Daniel said, Phil goes to jail because he has such a good imagination. He said he can imagine a world that's safe for children. And he can imagine a world without these weapons. And he can imagine a world where people are fed and taken care of. And that act of imagination so threatens the powers that they feel they have to lock him up. That's sort of been a challenge to us, rather than trying to put our energies on just saying this is bad or we don't want this. Trying to articulate, find people to share, how we articulate what we imagine we'd like to have and how we imagine how we ought to be. The specifics of all of that in terms of how we relate to the church stuff, I'll leave up to your questions and things at this point. That's sort of the, for me, the philosophical, theological, whatever other logical background and basis for our work, right? Questions or reactions.
I think we're going to start with Linda's question.
Okay.
What was it? Remember?
I don't think it was
very profound. Well, it was a question about How can we have safe cars and we can't end the arms race? Or we've handled some problems, and what keeps us from...
What keeps people from getting riled up about it versus
okay.
Baby food contamination?
Okay. The question has to do with, in a sense, what does it take to get people active enough or riled up enough to take decisive action to correct the situation. Is that fair?
I think, isn't there a sense where something about car safety or something is in people's eyes a lot more attainable? And I don't know, I think there's just so much fear involved, and I think fear like guilt to me is a paralyzing thing. It causes inaction. As long as we're afraid, as long as you've got guilt about it, you do less action, and I think there needs to be a freeing up of that. Free to act. And the nuclear thing, I think, caused a lot more fear than auto safety or, you know.
I think there's an element as well, the point at which it becomes personal to people. Car safety is very personal. You can understand that. I'm thinking when I used to work for the Quakers in 1970 or so, part of my job was going out and speaking about the Vietnam War in high schools and stuff. And when you do that, you develop sort of a rap, and there are always sort of illustrations you use. And I got into a point of trying to shock people into a reality about the war, and I would get into a section of my talk where there's a rather graphic description about shrapnel tearing through the body of a baby. I just sort of would try and shock them in that sense. And I'd done that a couple of times. And the first time I went out and gave that talk after my first daughter was born, I couldn't do it. I got halfway into it and I couldn't say the words because I had the reality of a child that I had held. And I couldn't say that part of the talk anymore. She's 12 now, so I can say it again. No. But that made that... I had gotten hardened and sort of aloof to that. I'm trying to think of the ways in which there's a campaign now, I don't know if it's as active in places you live, in many states having to do with drunk drivers. And what's motivated people has been the number of, especially children, who've been killed or people who've been crippled by drunk drivers, and it's made it very personal. And it seems doable. When you encounter people who have had a personal experience, people who live near Three Mile Island have a much clearer understanding and motivation in terms of opposing things. People in Utah who were exposed to test blasts, nuclear veterans who have leukemia now because the government chose to use them as guinea pigs. There's that personal connection. Most of us, through a combination of factors, have blinded ourselves or been shielded from the reality as it touches our lives, in that sense. And we'd rather not, in some ways, know about, because it's, as Dan was saying last night, it's depressing and grotesque, and I don't want to know. And at some point, it comes down to our own inability and reluctance, either to look at one another fully and see each other as human and to see the connections, and to come to grips with death in whatever form. It's a very difficult problem. One of the things that's been helpful to me personally, and a few others, I work one day a week in a hospice for cancer patients. And again, indebted to Daniel Berrigan here, does the same thing. Someone said, we don't understand the connection between working one day a week with people who are dying of cancer and then going to the Pentagon and throwing ashes on it. And he said, well, it's two things. It's dealing with individuals, having the privilege of dealing with individuals nearing their death gives a reality to the suffering, and what he calls a rehearsal for the seeming vocation of humanity in these times. And it gives you, again, a different perspective that you, the way we talk about it is most of us, if we think about life as a line this long, we'll almost always think of ourselves somewhere near the middle of it and not towards the end of it. To be able to share moments with people who are very clearly towards this end of it is a gift that you get to, again, change your perspective. From my understanding, what the gospel does for people is give them new eyes. It gives them a new way of seeing, new way of hearing, new way of perceiving. That whole passage of Jesus saying, you have heard it said, but now I say. You have, this is what you saw before, now look at it this way. To open people up in that way, to very easily we talk about a new reality, ways of seeing, ways of knowing, and people can share their stories about how they've changed. I was telling someone the other day about when I was in high school, I wanted to be a Marine. And if this were a different type of meeting, I could get up and testify about how I was trapped in the clutches of militarism, but then I was saved. I mean, I could do that kind of thing. Everybody has a story in terms of how they've grown and ways in which they change. And part of that putting in perspective as well is the need to look at it. I used to think, my father used to ask me when I worked for the Quakers, well, it's nice you have that job, but what are you going to do when the war's over for a job? And it'd be nice to be able to say, here, what are we going to do when the arms race is over? Dan said he was worried in publishing the book that what if the arms race ended before the book, before he sold all the copies? You'd be stuck with all these books. It's nice to think about it that way. I'd like to get on to other things. And in a sense, my partner in New York, the other coordinator of the Peace Fellowship, said to me one day after we had been in a meeting, a church meeting of some kind, he said, well, you know, sometimes I just wish I'd never heard of the arms race. If I never heard of it, I could spend my time going fishing and being with my family and stuff like all those guys we just left. But at this point, I really don't have any choice anymore. I can't do those things. And our struggle is to avoid making it such an obsession that we just give in and get eaten up another way. But to also put it in the perspective of saying, as far as I can tell, I'm open to miracles, but as far as I can tell, this is the struggle that I have through the rest of my ministry, however long that is, and being optimistic, say 30 to 40 years. And then if it works out that way, it's what my daughter gets to do for the rest of her life too. That can be real discouraging. And again, it calls for a different perspective. I'll come back to that a lot. When David Harris, who was a Vietnam war resister, came out of jail after serving some time, a reporter asked him and said, well, you've been in jail now for 3 years. Aren't you discouraged the war is still going on? And David said, well, no. He said, when I went in, we thought our chances of ending were about 1 in 1,000,000. Now it's about 1 in 10,000. We're getting better. we're getting closer. It's not easy to relax in that kind of perspective, but you don't really have much other choice. One of the things we've learned from our work in the parish, and is where the connection comes, sort of what Dan was saying last night, as we stood on the stand on the steps of the church, I can look just down the street and choose what I want to work on. Do I want to work on drug rehabilitation or food or housing or all those things? And then having chosen one, sort of come up and say, well, this is foolish. We can't feed all the people in the city. There's really nothing we can do about hunger in this city. So that being the case, we're free to do anything. We're freed from the expectation of results and success and all of that. And once you're free to do something and do anything, you're a lot lighter about it and things start to happen. That's not something I learned in seminary. It takes a while of experience and of basically of failing or being disappointed with your own efforts to come up with that sort of thing and putting that sort of expectation up against the seeming power of the Pentagon and being able to say, no, that's just the illusion of power in there. That's not power itself. It's the illusion of power. It's another set of lies we talked about last night. And I'll bank on the truth if I can as I search for it, as I experiment with it. Whatever. I'd be interested from my own... I mentioned the Plowshares 8. Are you aware of... How aware are you of numbers of people around the country who are presently in jail or expecting to go to jail for those kinds of actions, for going into factories or into plants and actually beating on submarines and stuff? Do you know?
I don't know how many there are, but there are some from Washington State that we know.
Yeah. The list is... I don't know presently because it changes all the time, but I know in Connecticut itself I have at least 10 friends, and there's some in Colorado, Iowa, state of Washington. You have to really look through not just newspapers but other sources of information like our newsletter or Sojourners or Fellowship, or there's actually a special newsletter just dealing with people in jail because of nuclear protests. To keep people up to date on trial proceedings and stuff. A witness that we need to be aware of in many ways that always sort of is at an edge for many of us, and you may dismiss it, but you, in doing so, I think need to at least be able to articulate what you're doing instead. You can say it's not worthwhile, but what then is, and what are you willing to do? And you don't all have to do that, but at least be able to ask the question. What's appropriate for you, and at what points do you change that, and what would it take to make that kind of risk or sacrifice? Soldiers in the military, for whatever reasons, are prepared to crawl through snow and mud and endure all kinds of hardships. It's going to take at least that kind of devotion and effort, probably without the same kind of training and conditioning, if we are going to have any hope at all of counteracting that.
You know what I struggle with is it seems like we don't have much of a democracy if something like that bill that Dan was talking about last night can't get passed, where we can actually have a... In different polls, you know, they've had results as high as, you know, like 70% of people saying that for disarmament, at least bilateral nuclear disarmament and going farther than Iran, yet it doesn't seem to matter. You know, I mean, forget who it was, but after New York this summer, you know, 750,000 people there, and some legislator said it won't slow us down a bit. It doesn't matter to us. You know,
I guess a lot is that if you're looking at the nuclear issue as a faith statement and saying no to an idolatry and no to a lie or a sense of false security, that also means that you say no even if everyone else says yes, mm-hmm. including even if the Russians, supposedly your enemies or whatever, say yes. And I think that that is something that would be an issue that a lot of people in the
mm-hmm.
A lot of people watching.
If they just went by to know, they just
fulfill that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's very
I think each of us, and we said last, I was talking to some people last night, and as much as I do this, you always have some sort of doubt about saying, well, maybe there's one case where I, you know, what about this? And you start always struggling with, maybe I'm not quite right here. Maybe we need just a couple of soldiers for this or that or whatever. And it's also necessary in that case to also have the perspective. People will often say to me, as we're talking, they say, well, if we just disarm tomorrow, the Soviets would come in and march through Columbus, Ohio, and break into the library at the seminary and whatever. And you have to say, let's talk about the real world, okay? We're not going to disarm in one day. I mean, that's not even worth discussing. We're not. I mean, I'd rather than talking about hypothetical situations, talk about reality. How do we begin the process of dismantling one weapon? How do we begin the process of doing things that, in fact, don't threaten our lives at all, but enhance them, and try to get people away from defending themselves by those sort of hypothetical, what would you do if, what would you do if, you know, what would you do if your wife was being attacked? Well, I'd protect her. What do I do? The reality is, what do I do when my neighborhood's being attacked, not by the Soviet Union, but by the Pentagon? I try to protect it. And that's not comfortable. I mean, it's much more comfortable to live off in all sorts of situations that obscure the truth for us, but we all have a case like that, where I'd you know, which is one sort of test case for us. And it comes down to a matter of the real difficulty of trust, of faith, of what in another time was called cheap grace, of saying, you can't have it both ways, that this is going to be real costly. I'd rather not think that the demands of this work and the kind of things we're talking about could interfere with people's families and would lead to the breakup of families, but it does. And they say, what kind of God does that? Well, in the midst of that, you have to say, somehow it seems to be a loving God who keeps calling us to confront wherever the idols are. Even my mother and father? Yeah. Even your mother and father. Even my pastor? Yeah. That's hard for pastors to say. it's hard for each of us to say. And it comes back to that never enough, not enough. Well, I don't want to hear that. I want to go on vacation. You know? A friend who was looking for a call as a pastor and decided he wanted to try to find a ministry, find a church that wasn't in some kind of proximity to a military installation or a nuclear power plant. He couldn't do it.
Say, where did he go? Yeah.
He happens to be in Jersey City right now, which is not an improvement. But that was sort of a revelation. When I first talked to, a couple of years ago, I was talking to kids from North Dakota. I had two responses. One is, and this I thought was a very nice response, when I talked to them about my neighborhood and difficulties, and they said, that may be true, but we've never seen it. We don't blame us if we're not involved in that. We really don't know about that, and we need to learn. But the other one was them. They're saying they had the feeling that with all the missiles in place in North Dakota and such, that they were safe, that New York and Washington would be the targets. And I had to say, well, that's one possible scenario, but not very likely. You're probably much more of a target in some ways than New York and Washington, the Eastern Seaboard. And they had never looked at the missiles as a threat before. They'd always sort of thought they were their security. Again, that's a different perspective. What are these things doing here? What do they really mean? If you get a chance, do any of you know Charlie King, a singing group called Bright Morning Star? It's a real nice song called, it's not a nice song, a song called Acceptable Risks. And it's just testimony of a guy who had been, as a soldier in the 50s, one of the test groups, and been driven out to Yucca Flats and exposed to a nuclear blast. And at the time of his testimony, he had leukemia and was dying. And the refrain of it just keeps going over and over. We were told the risks were all acceptable. Acceptable. Acceptable to who? And it's a real sort of chilling, frightening thing as he sort of details from his hospital bed. You know, believing, the government wouldn't do something like that to you, right? And winding up where he was, and asking that question. Acceptable to who? As Dan was saying last night, just interesting lies. You're lying again. Tell the truth. Tell me why. All those kind of things that they're so difficult for us to do. We like to be liked, right? We'd rather be the advisors to the king than the critics of the king, because the advisors get to be part of the state banquets and all that stuff. And that's part of the struggle we have within the church, with our own structures, our own hierarchies.
Go back to Linda's question, why this seems such a complicated homeless issue, and something like unsafe cars seems like a simple one. I think maybe it's because there's so many people on the other side who are working on that side for the same reasons that we are working on this side, precisely because they see it as a face. I remember reading, I think it was Jim Wallace's Margins column, Sojourner Group, and go speak to 50 of the top brass and ask the chaplain, why are most of these people involved? And the chaplain said it's because of the religious reasons that they feel that this is a Christian response. And that's so frightening to me, that not because I think the people at the Pentagon are evil people, but they think they're doing it with very good intentions because of the gospel. And I'm wondering how much effort should we just spend on Bible study, or is that a lot of the problem, or is it that there are evil people up there?
I have sort of two reactions, as I've dealt not so much with military people, with engineers and civilian weapons designers. We used to think about a lot of them, say, well, they're just trapped in their jobs, they'd like to be designing efficient recycling systems, but this is the only work they can get, and they'd like, actually some of them really like what they're doing. I mean, in that sense, they just worship Mars, some of them. They're warrior worshipers. But many of them, in fact, are trapped or need, there are places for dialogue. What troubles me in dealing with that, and it's a change for me, I can remember 15 or 14 years ago being probably part of a crowd that was chanting things similar to, hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? It's not the most creative or constructive response at the time, but there's a lot of anger, right? The problem with whether it's the engineers or the military people is not, I think, that they're so extraordinarily evil. What frightens me is that they're probably just like I am. And if they're that sinful and that prone to violence and destruction, that frightens me. I mean, I have to, in that sense, for me, the matter of repentance and the gospel has to do with looking at the ways in which my participation in violence and such is there, and how much I like it and how much I profit from it. And these guys are just the same and need the fellowship and support to help with the turnaround. So I mean, to say they're evil, yeah, as evil as the rest of us. And then the task becomes one of evangelism. In that sense, for the church, whether it's Bible study or like Jim Wallace, we were talking about doing sort of a disarmament revival tour, get a big tent and go across the country with a couple of preachers and set up towns and just get out from that tradition and start preaching and testifying and do whatever we can to try and reach out to people in their own situations. And you find people, one of the things that keeps you going is finding the testimonies of people who have in fact been touched, been able to break free and start over, engineers and military people who have just resigned, who said no, not large numbers. And then you start to say, well, what, do we leave it just up to them? Or if we're a community, how do we help support people who expect them to leave their jobs? How they're going to feed their kids? Well, you start to set up ways, funds, and whatever to do that, or you find groups. There's a group in Massachusetts now called High Technology Professionals for Peace, which is a job placement agency for engineers and others who'd like to get out of weapons research and into something else. We need to be as deliberate about the structures and the ways we approach things as, in this case, the other side, as military planners are. There are people working round the clock to keep the military machine going, and there are people working part-time and in their spare hours and whatever to try to stop them. To be as deliberate in our planning and our education, our training, as the military is. Somehow we have the expectation that war is something you need to prepare for, and that peace just sort of happens in some way that we don't understand, then it just sort of pop up, you know, out of the ground somewhere. It's as deliberate a process in our situation as anything else is. And we need educational systems and Sunday school materials and training and all of that kind of stuff. Training for preachers. For everybody, teachers, whatever. And the ways in which their vocation is affected, or in ways in which their vocation can affect the situation. In recognition that it's a struggle that we all share.
I can really see the point, too, of people thinking that it's some kind of almost holy crusade or something. You know, one thing that struck me is, like, today in class, we're talking about this book where these guys kill a couple of guys because they're afraid if they don't, they'll get them first. And we're saying, you know, this is kind of analogous to the nuclear situation, although here it seems like really sure they're going to get them first. But we were all rooting for them, like, yeah, kill them, you know, get the guys first. And then, you know, when we talked about it, like David Weiss said that he had taught the book in a class before, and no one had brought up the moral issue at all, and he hadn't brought it up either. And that, you know, we just, it's so much part of our mentality, a kind of a self-defense, and however we perceive it being self-defense, that's what we go for. And even, you know, here I've been going to these things every night, and I've been talking about it, I've been aware of the issue for a while, and doing a lot of reading and stuff, and I read that book, and I go, get them, or they'll get you, you know. And so it's so ingrained to us that I think it's really, it's we're not so different than those people sometimes, I think, is that they perceive our security as resting on something we don't.
I was interested in your statement about the people who are actually working on military things. We hear our tax dollars daily at home bombing their big jet engines all around us all the time. And I know some of them, of course, and you and daily living, and they live in our community, and they're in our school systems and PA and everywhere. And I was part of it for a while myself. And I mean, that's the reason I'm against nuclear power plants, because the people run them are just like everybody else, and they need to be something more. They need to be more accurate than the machines that they program, and they're not. And so they leaflet at Triton every morning.
Right.
They hand leaflets to the people as they go into work every morning. I don't know if they're still doing it, but they've been doing it for months. And it's just a little note saying, you know, this, anytime you want to opt out of this job, we'll try to help you. And are you sure this is really the job that you need for your life? And boy, it's powerful stuff. And the Buddhists built a pagoda, sort of a thing, a peace prayer place at Trident. The county said that it was illegal and that they couldn't get a building permit, and then in the middle of the night after it was almost built, 10 years ago, I can't imagine. There are lots and lots of people who've been burned down. But it's really, we really should feel great compassion for the people working in those places.
I wonder if part of our difficulty in getting us concerned about this issue, as for instance, cars or whatever, if it could be because we are a wealthy nation, we're supposedly successful, we're a technological nation, and if we have this illusion that we're little gods, and that indeed we can overcome anything, and that by God Valley, we're going to push it to the limits and do exactly that. If we kind of get, if we have a mindset like this, and that that we're just, nothing can destroy us, and we'll overcome. And that's part of that sinful condition again.
Right. One of the two responses that I found lately from people, one that it took me a long time to hear, when I'd speak to groups, especially in churches, at some point people would say, well, yeah, the weapons are wrong and we know there's problems, but it's a variation on Russian invasion. We need them to protect what we have, right? And it took me a while to realize, to be able to say to people, exactly, and that's not the solution, that's not the answer, that's the problem. We have these weapons specifically not because of a Russian threat, not because of, but because we have things that we feel need to be protected by weapons like this, whether it's our Ataris or our degrees or whatever, that the weapons exist to preserve a way of life, which in fact is a way of death. But people think that's the solution and that's a justification, and to be able to come from the perspective of saying, no, that's the problem, in fact, you're going to have to be willing to give up some things. Yeah, I know that's hard. The other one that surprised me, I saw that at Wartburg College in Waverly, one of the professors showed a film from the Japanese Lutheran Church has given some films to churches here about Hiroshima and the survivors. And one of the responses from students at Wartburg, in one class at least, after they saw it, it was a film with a lot of photos of the survivors, the Hibakusha. One of the students, or a couple of them, actually said, well, you see, it's not so bad. You can survive a nuclear attack. They survived. And there's that sort of quest in us for any sort of justification or any sort of way from hiding from the truth and saying, yeah, they have sores on their back or whatever, they have leukemia, but they survived. It's not, maybe it's not as bad as you've been saying. We start to fool ourselves and think, maybe it's not so bad. Maybe we can survive. The other side of that, going back to the engineers, one of the difficulties, and I've heard engineers actually say this, well, we don't really know what these weapons can do. It's all theoretical. We work it out on computers, but we've never really tried them, other than that one time in Japan, and our weapons now are so much different. It wouldn't be so bad to just try one. Let me, you know, sound like little kids. Let's just try one or two and see what they actually do. And there's sort of that impatience of, it's the same sort of, you can probably get away with that. I mean, that's, you know, how bad could it be? It's just a little one kind of thing. One of my favorite shirts during the June 12th rally, one group was selling t-shirts that had a caricature of, in this case, Ronald Reagan and Brezhnev, so struggling with missiles. But all it said on it was, take the toys from the boys. Yeah, that sums up in a lot. If you can put yourself in that mindset when you're talking or listening to military planners and others, these are kids with big toys. And we abide behavior and excuses from them that we wouldn't take from our kids. As someone pointed out, if you walked out in your yard and your kids are fighting and one says, well, he hit me first, you say, I don't care who hit first, no hitting here. Okay, that's just where we start. And we abide behavior from national leaders and from governments that we wouldn't from our neighbors. If someone in your neighborhood acted the way that the president does in terms of stockpiling weapons in their house because they thought that all these people were out to get them, at some point we'd probably find some way to have them examined and restrained. But we say, oh no, this is the government. So that means it's a special set of rules here, that all the rules about how people ought to behave and what kind of community we'd like to have don't apply for some reason. Same with the draft. If I go into your house and take your kid, I'm liable to be prosecuted. If the government comes and do it, it's called legal in the draft. It's hard for us to get in the position of calling the government to accountability in that way, or thinking the government is ours and not some group of strangers in three-piece suits or helmets. In most cases.
you wonder what kind of dream world we're in sometimes when we're spending $4.2 billion now on crisis relocation planning, and if Reagan gets his way, it'll go up to $10 billion, and that's to make shelters in the cities so the key industrial workers can stay. And you know, that's like, you know, I mean, if you're a key industrial, sure, I'll stay here and bring the bomb and carry on the American way, you know, so we can rebuild. It's like, are we for real, you know?
Are you familiar with a book called With Enough Shovels?
Yeah.
Based on a comment from a Reagan official, government official, with a plan of people could survive a nuclear attack, we had enough shovels, they could dig ditches and cover them with doors and then shovel dirt on top. And for the first few times it went around, people were discussing it. It took a while before someone actually said, who's supposed to shovel the dirt? You know, are you going to ask your wife to do that? Or what? I mean, who gets to stay outside and shovel the dirt on the migrant workers? What do you, you know? Somebody's got to be outside the hole, shoveling on top. But it's in some way symbolic of the kind of thinking that you don't go all the way to the end. It sounds good, it looks good, whatever.
Well, there may be hope. Even the Reader's Digest is pointing out how ludicrous that is.
Yeah. Well, one of the things they said was if you got this, if you could get the dirt up onto the roof of the foot of dirt on the roof of the church, which is the fallout shelter, how would you make it stay there? That was the pitch of the roof. And the other question was, how could anybody shovel dirt that's frozen solid? I loved it.
It'll thaw quick after the blast. One of the things that we've chosen rather deliberately in Lutheran Peace Fellowship, and we try to do, is really focus our concerns about the arms race and militarism within the church community. I mean, you have to deal with the government at some point, but also to say, what does it really mean to have ROTC on church-related campuses? What does it mean to not have peace studies on church-related campuses? What does it mean to allow military recruiters free access to church-related campuses? What's the whole structure of military chaplaincy mean? The investment of our pension funds in weapons manufacture? All those sort of questions that come up, for us anyway, within the church community. In 1978, at the time of the first UN session on disarmament, we had petitions and things we took to Andy Young, who was then the UN ambassador. And he accepted them and he said, you know, the government's not going to pay much attention to this because you're asking the government to make a priority out of something that the churches aren't willing to do themselves. That so much of what we've done until recently in the church has been a variation on you guys ought to. The government ought to do this, and the government ought to do this, but we'll continue to live on the benefits of the system as it exists. And until the church is willing to restructure its own priorities and make some changes in their own structure in their own house, we really, until we get the log out of our own eye, in that sense, it's difficult to speak with much moral authority to what others ought to be doing. And there are obviously hopeful signs within the Christian community, from the Catholic bishops to even Lutheran bishops in a small way, and others being at least willing to make tentative steps towards discovering what that means for ourselves. Wonderful stories about Catholic bishops refusing to allow their school kids to participate in contests to name a battleship or to allow the schools to be used for shelters and raise questions about that.
I heard, I think it was the Mennonite church providing peace book covers at great schools. So many, you can get all the Air Force book covers.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
And they're providing an alternative.
Right.
Toys are another big
thing. Toys. The whole question of what's become called parenting for peace and justice. If you're going to raise kids, how do you raise them within this society? I mean, obviously all interconnected, but how you raise them to deal with various sex role expectations, but then also their toys, consumer mentality, all those things that will lead us up to, it was no accident that I wanted to be a Marine when I was 18. You know? That was as much a part of my schooling and all my unofficial schooling as anything else. And that's where I should have come out, given the way I was trained. And I told the story that the reason I didn't, in fact, was because they wanted me to cut my hair.
And I said you were lucky because you found out before you went there.
Right. Very quickly, I was 18 and leaving high school, and a recruiter had suggested I go to college and join this officer training program. And when I went for the final interview, the officer said, "Well, we're all set. I just want you to go get your hair cut." My hair probably wasn't, nobody here has hair as short as it was then. Maybe Carl. Well, Tom. Probably Carl's hair is maybe as long as my hair was then in 65. And I said, "I'm willing to cut it in 13 months. He said, "No, cut it today, let it grow for 13 months, but I want you to cut it today." And when I left there, I was really hurt. And I said, "Maybe there's more to the Marines than those flashy uniforms and other things." And it started me thinking. But that was the thing that threw all that off the track for me. And it comes in unexpected ways to people. It's hard to explain. Often, and the hardest thing to explain to my family in some way is to say, "No, actually what I'm doing now is what you taught me to do. You took me to Sunday school, you taught me all that stuff about not killing, taught me to respect other people. This is what happens." They're okay about it, most of them. But that's a struggle, of being willing to take it back to, as we talked the other day, to families and not just talk to strangers. To go places you don't want to go and deal with this stuff. It's real hard. We didn't all talk about it, and I'd be happy to do that sometime. We don't know yet how all this fits into the struggle and the process about forming another Lutheran church. Not exactly a new Lutheran church. But we're in some dialogue with that, and I'd welcome suggestions or if you have any thought about that and how these things ought to relate.
Yeah, well, do you have any visions or dreams about the new church?
Nightmares. No, one of the things we've pretty clearly decided that however that turns out, that it's important to maintain an independent voice outside of whatever structure comes up. For two reasons. One is that whatever structure there is will not yet be all Lutherans. And the second that house prophets just don't... We're not interested in being prophets either. But you just do more things and raise the questions in other ways. I think the model that we're using is seeing the formation of the church as an opportunity to sort of lay some foundations or some cornerstones while everything else is changing. And I don't want to make that sound surreptitious or sneaky. In 1961, whenever it was that the LCA was formed, prior to that, there had been some activity in regard to conscientious objection and recognizing that as a church stand. And there had been places here and there where that was done. In the excitement of forming the new church, that was accepted as a stance of the newly formed church. There were ways in which sort of the groundwork, foundational things could be included. We're trying to determine what those things are now. I guess my most optimistic would be that if the ALC is serious about a 5-year commitment to the mandate for peacemaking, and that after 5 years there in fact are Sunday school materials and evangelism materials and all these things relating to peacemaking as ministry, that will impact in some way on the new structure. That it will then be familiar enough to people going in that it will make sense to have it there. The sort of counter presence to that is the fact that the LCA doesn't have a similar kind of emphasis, and in fact in some ways acts hostily to those sort of concerns. I don't expect Lutheran Church to declare itself a historic peace church, but at least, at the very least, to maintain the recognition that whatever they come up with for what they call the church and society emphasis will be an openness and a process towards the kinds of things that we're involved in. The mandate for peacemaking, besides having eliminated the staff person that John talked about and the money commitment on the grounds that it was only a token to do that, also eliminated, as I recall, a very specific endorsement of tax resistance and resistance activities. But the fact that it even got into the first draft to be rejected was a new thing, that it appeared in some Lutheran documents was a big thing. I try to be optimistic about all that. If I weren't, I couldn't stay here.
Say a little more about the LCA being possible.
Yeah. For a variety of reasons that I don't fully understand, that have to do with both the polity of the LCA as opposed to the ALC. The ALC, for those who care, is much more decentralized operation, and therefore are not as threatened, for some reason, by independent agencies doing work, and they're willing to cooperate with a Lutheran Human Relations Association or a Lutheran Peace Fellowship because they can recognize them as resources, and they don't feel bound to them, and they don't feel we're trying to take advantage of them. They may react that way to individuals at times, but not to organizations. The LCA, through a combination of personalities involved and the structure of the church, feels a need to maintain much more centralized control over materials that are used, over ideas, and things like that. And in this area in particular, the people with direct responsibility for these questions initially, and that would be the Office of Church and Society of the DMNA, have an historic phobia almost about the idea of pacifism, and have much more of a history that falls on the side of what I called before, seeing themselves as advisors to the king. That position of insisting in some ways that their theology, as they understand it, be right before they do anything. And I have no, I'm not here advocating wrong theology, but there's a point of not being able to say, well, we don't know for sure, but we're going to try it. That so controls their response to this, that in some way that I don't fully understand, the LCA offices see congregational initiative and an autonomous or independent reactions as a threat to their work rather than as a direction or an aid. And that's just a struggle. That's a matter of sort of questioning the individual principalities and fiefdoms that have built up in that structure. That it's a matter of questioning the whole sort of business managerial mentality that the LCA has adopted in more force than the ALC. The real danger is that people in the ALC look at the LCA in many ways with longing and envy. They say, we'd love to have that much centralized control, and we'd love to be able to do that. So I think that in some way, as we talk about the new church process, one of the struggles is to counteract that thinking and to try to allow the room for varied expressions within the church. There's also been, in ways, again, that I don't understand, just a wholesale buying into traditional, I don't want to say worldly, academic disciplines that say, when we look at the church's response to the arms race, the experts that inform the church are political scientists and military thinkers almost exclusively, and theologians who would be considered traditionally Lutheran, and sort of a dangerous Lutheran parochialism that says other traditions have nothing to say to us. That that the LCA, since their last convention, reluctantly, in terms of the offices, approved resolutions to look into these questions. And the response paper acted in two ways. One, as though there's been nothing done in the Christian community on these questions in the past 2,000 years that's worth looking at. And the second assumption, that when we're talking about, they have no sense of history as well, because they talk about our approach to the weapons and trying to guard against the mentality that says that just because we have them, they will be used, with no awareness that the weapons have been used, and without being willing to look at the reality of that. It's, in the worst sense, can be characterized as living, it's not even living in a fantasy land, it's living in a very walled-in, protected I this is the most extreme I've ever put it, that I think that views the gospel and the mission of the church as a threat to the institution. And that's real hard to counteract. And they hide behind academic arrogance I mean, I had at one point when I was speaking at a seminary, Maynard, or you can tell me, when I spoke at that time, the question was raised, what authority I had speaking to seminary students about ministry, because I was only a parish pastor. And it's that sort of attitude. You guys are only, you guys are only parish pastors, and you know, what right do you have talking about theology? You're not theologians, you're not all that thing. And you want to bring Mennonite theologians here? Catholics? No. It's just such a guarded, fearful response. That's the only way I can... That's putting it gently. I mean, another friend of mine just says they just know their backs are against the wall. Culturally, every other way. Institutionally, they're just up against it. Wherever they turn. Women, the military, foreign missions, they just can't get away from these things that are challenging them and confronting their worldview. In that sense, it's a dinosaur theology. Too much armor and too little vision. And it's a system, and now I'm not just talking about the LCA, it's a system that lives off of and profits from the same system that's protected by those weapons. At that point, the churches have a vested interest in maintaining the arms race. I had toyed with the idea when the LCA endorsed SALT II treaty, I was going to print a newsletter with a headline that said, LCA endorses increased arms spending. Because that was the outcome of endorsing the SALT II treaty. It meant more. I didn't do that. I thought better of it at the moment. Just in terms of future considerations of dealing with them. But it's, they don't look ahead to, they don't have that different perspective. Or they have a different perspective than I do. And they have, in some ways, some authority to deal with us, or not deal with us in certain ways. And I increasingly become interested, for a variety of personal reasons, in dealing with that. I'd rather work on, in essence, raising the questions about the order of our own house and our own within our own churches. As a basic ministry question, I've just had too many people have told me they used to be Lutherans, but the church said nothing about their lives, whether it had to do with alcoholism or the arms race. And it just seems to me an evangelical imperative to counteract that before we lose too many more people. And the excuse that you'll disrupt the ministry is already disrupted. It's already a shambles. People are leaving. And they just recognize the sham that it is in many ways. And we make a choice about who we're going to minister to, just as you do in the chaplaincy, in the military. You don't really deal with the most disaffected or don't trust the church because it's in a uniform, but the price is we get to deal with other people who also need ministry, but we limit ourselves so much. You obviously asked the right question to hit a button for me.